Last week, we ended up with a very long discussion on a particular verse. If you would, turn back to the epistle or sermon to the Hebrews. We ended up digging through one particularly thorny interpretational problem. If you read the book of Hebrews, chapter 1, verse 6. At this point, we're in the middle of a bunch of quotations from the Old Testament, where the author of Hebrews is making an argument based on the scriptures. All right? Remember that when the author of Hebrews wrote this, there might not have been any New Testament scripture yet. We're not sure when this was written. And so for him, what is scripture? Scripture is the Old Testament. So he's making an argument and he's quoting from various different places. And so in verse 6, he says, and again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, let all God's angels worship him. And we sent this back. We all went back to Deuteronomy. And it was back to Deuteronomy chapter 32:43. Rejoice with him, O heavens, bow down to him, all gods, for he avenges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land. And we talked about the fact that depending on your translation, you may not have that verse or that part of the verse at all. All right. And just as a very quick recap, if we think about a timeline, and we were to assume that the book of Deuteronomy was written in, we'll go with 1400 BC. All right. And if we are in 2022, all right, how did this happen? Well, let's just say that, all right, we have the book of Hebrews right here. All right. If we say Hebrews was written in, let's say, AD 70 or whatever. Lots of debates on that. That's there. He's using a selection from a verse that, when you look at the KJV, which is obviously done before our time, you won't see it in the KJV. You also won't see it in the NKJV. And depending on, for example, the ESV, depending on what edition of the ESV you have, you may or may not see it. Because apparently, they either added it or took it away from their verse in Deuteronomy. And we have to ask the question, why? And this is what we went through last time. The author of Hebrews, all right, he is a witness to say that actually that verse was there. What else do we have from that? Well, if we look at these modern translations, these were all based on what is called, roughly at this point, this would be like 700 to 1,000, all right? What is called the MT, or the Masoretic Text. And so these are nice Hebrew manuscripts from a great deal of time after this particular point, all right? But our, generally speaking, our the Old Testament of the KJV and the NKJV, and a lot of what we use in the Old Testament is based off of these manuscripts, and these manuscripts certainly do not have what you have in the author, in the book of the Hebrews here. And so where does it come from? If Hebrews knows about it, is there any other evidence for it? And the answer is yes. And we talked about how the LXX, a.k.a. the Septuagint, what is the Septuagint?
70. Greek translation.
It means 70, and it is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, named after the supposedly 70 translators of that. And so you've got a bunch of Jews who don't speak Hebrew, or Greeks that want to be Jewish, all right, that also don't speak or read Hebrew. And so they translate the Hebrew Bible at that time, much older than this text, into Greek. And many Jews used that. And when the church happened, many of the Christians also used this as well. And as more of the church was Greek, not Jewish, the Septuagint was in fact the Bible of the early church. Give or take, give it 100 years and you've got mostly Greek speaking, and that is true. The New Testament authors, depending on the New Testament author, you'll get different things. Yeah. That is a good question. I don't have an answer. The oldest full copy of the Septuagint in a single book is the 4th century A.D. All right.
Isn't that the museum in
Depends on which piece of it. It was broken up into pieces. Long story. Basically, Guy stole part of Codex Sinaiticus, took part of it to the British Library. Part of it is still in the original monastery on the Arabian Peninsula. So, but yes, most of it would be actually in the British Library. But you do have older selections from back here in the BC, early AD. Yeah.
The Septuagint, is that like the one Septuagint, or is that just what is called the Greek translation?
That is a fantastic question, actually. Generally speaking, all right, people will look at the Septuagint and go, it is not a monolithic thing, as if 72 people really did sit down and do it all at one time. That's not a good representation of the history of it. But generally speaking, it's the word for the Greek translation. And for the most part, it's fairly stable, and there's not like a bunch of different people translating the same thing. I don't know if that's helpful or not. That's a really complicated question. It'll be good to go through it sometime for the nerds. Yeah? Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. We also have witness, and if you've got the Greek people, all right, the Greek speakers translating from Hebrew into that, and it's in the Septuagint, that means it was in whatever Hebrew manuscripts they were using at this point. And this has been known for a long time, because the church has been using the Septuagint since the church happened. Now, in terms of other witnesses, something we didn't know into the 50s, there was the finding of the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls did actually have a Hebrew manuscript with essentially this in it. And so we're like, okay, now it's a really hard question. And this is one of those things where people will, you will get debate on this, because the data is genuinely ambiguous. And so I went through that last time, A, because it's in our text and it's worth explaining, but also just to expose some of you to the funds of what is called textual criticism. And if you're interested, I've got books I can recommend you for you to read. Today we're going to continue on our study of Hebrews, much less textual criticism today. Let's just study the Old Testament and see how the New Testament reflects on it. If you would, if you don't have it already, you're going to open yourself up to the book of Hebrews, chapter 1. And I'm going to ask you, if you look in your Bibles, where does it say, if yours has the notes, Hebrews 1:7, where does it say that verse comes from?
The quote.
The quote. He's quoting something. Where does it come from? Psalm 104, verse 4. So if you turn to Psalm, this is what your group's going to be talking about in a second. Psalm 104, verse 4, it says this. He makes his messengers winds and his ministers a flaming fire. Now, I'm going to give you a few minutes as a group, and here is essentially your discussion. All right? Read the context of Psalm 104. All right? Figure out what that's about in its own context. And then the next question is to ask, why would the author of Hebrews use this verse? Okay? So read it as a group. I'll give you a few minutes. You'll want to pair with somebody. And we'll talk about it in a minute.
Also, at the John, he was under the influence of light. So now mountains rose, the valleys came down. He set a boundary between the Sargon and the Sabre, so that they might not exist in the future.
Give you one more minute. Hey, Chip, your team figure it out?
Figure what out?
Well, why would he pick this verse? Don't say yet. Don't say it. You have another 20 seconds. All right. And the reason why we're doing this, just to make sure we're clear, is you've got the author of Hebrews here. He is making an argument. He is trying to prove his case. All right. He's clearly writing this to a group of people who take this document, right? The Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, or the Septuagint. All right. They take it as authoritative. So he's making an argument. I'm going to tell you what is true. And just like we do, I'm going to tell you what is true based on the Bible. All right. And so what that means is when they quote a Bible verse, that's generally what they're doing. It's good to stop and say, OK, if he's doing that, what did he actually see in the Old Testament? All right. And so do we have a group that can tell us what, contextually speaking, what is the point of Psalm 104:4?
I see two reasons why he might have picked this. The first one is the psalm is talking about how God is over creation.
Mm-hmm.
So the author of Hebrews is arguing that Jesus is supreme, so he would have to be over creation for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then verse 4, his messengers are ministers to him. That sort of is continuing his argument that he's above the angels in authority. And, yeah.
Okay. Now let's go back to Hebrews, all right? Contextually there, how does that, if that's true, and I think you're totally right, how does that fit with what the author of Hebrews is trying to do right there? Instead of just guessing what it is, we're going to be explicit. What point, what in the author's argument, all right, why is this here? Not this team. Somebody, some other team. Why is it here?
The
go ahead.
The angels are supposed to worship him. They're made for him.
That's right. They are made for him, right? And so let all God's angels worship him. And again, when he says, when he brings the firstborn into world, all right, let all God's angels worship him. Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. They are a created thing. They are meant to serve God and serve his son. Right? That is why they're using this. From a background standpoint, why would this language even be here? And a minor point, but for those who are interested in studying more, all right, when you're talking about really old stuff, and so this would be really old stuff written way back here-ish, all right, when you're talking really old stuff, old Hebrew, we don't have a lot of documents from that period of time that are in Hebrew, other than the Old Testament itself. So that's extremely rare in terms of even inscriptions. But you can find the occasional small thing. So what Hebrew scholars often do is they will look at other literature from that time period, and they will go, all right, we're going to find cognate languages and go, maybe this word only shows up once in the Old Testament, but it's used a lot in this other language that is related to Hebrew. Maybe that'll help us understand a little bit. And you might remember this guy. He shows up a number of times in the Old Testament. Remember that guy? Baal, however you want to pronounce it. This is actually relevant here. Because there is, if you look in Canaanite mythology, okay, there's a fight between a man named, a fake god named Baal and a fake god named Yom. All right? Yom is actually the Hebrew word for sea. And so it's Baal versus the sea god. Well, we don't believe there was a sea god, right? Obviously. What you've got here is one of two things in Psalm 104. When it talks about the messengers as winds and his ministers a flaming fire, that language specifically, the ministers as angels of flaming fire, is used of Yom's ministering angels. All right? And so Baal ends up defeating the sea god in their theology. What you've got here in your Old Testament is either one of really two things. Either you've got these notions borrowing from Old Testament ideas, or you've got an explicit critique of Canaanite mythology saying God, the true God, Yahweh God, he is the one who makes the angels like flames of fires and ministers, not Yom and not Baal. And so that's a whole another thing. If anybody's interested, you can go read about. But the author of Hebrews, fairly simply, use it as the angels are ministers. Right? They do things. They're servants. They are not themselves to be worshipped. Unlike the firstborn. When the firstborn is brought into the world, let the angels of God worship him. Any questions or thoughts on that? Go ahead.
No?
Okay. All right. Now, let's look at Hebrews chapter 1, verse 8. Says this, but of the Son, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And we won't go on yet. That first quote, your Bibles, what does it say it's from? Psalm 45. Okay. Take your groups. I'm going to give you a little bit more time. I want you to read that context thoroughly. All right. What's going on there? Try to figure out who's talking. All right. Make sure you understand who is talking to whom. That's very important in this particular case. So Psalm 45. Read and see what you can see.
Yeah. Okay, so is this talking about God?
I think it's like specifically talking about David and then like being a picture of.
The thing about it is, it definitely changes what it's talking about. Well, I think you can say, oh, it's talking about Jesus the whole time, and right there it's still talking about Jesus, but you can definitely make the argument, like, it definitely does change your time about some verse 10, which is it, oh, God, so it might seem important to me, but I think what the other passage is arguing is that he's talking
about
It's also another thing that lines up, you know, the prophecy and Jesus. You know, some of the people that go, yeah, this is from the Old Testament. This is what I'm interpreting.
The reason I said I similar is because I saw this before. I of the world on the side first and of course,
Early proto-Trinitarian theology. In that case, early and proto are redundant, but yeah. Yeah. It's fun to say it. Actually, if you want to be sound cooler, you would say incipient proto or early incipient proto-Trinitarian. Incipient means something that happens at the beginning. So, depends on how fancy you want to say it. All right, it's been 5 minutes, so let's chat about this one. What is going on in this psalm in the Old Testament? What in the world is going on? Anybody? That's right. That's right. And so what does the psalm itself say? Who is the psalm addressed to? You're absolutely right, Chip. Who is the psalm addressed to? Who is it? Well, I should say, who is it talking about? That really is the question here, right?
Where it says, you're God, and therefore God, your God, I think he's speaking about the second person of the Trinity.
Okay. And so if you start at the beginning, all right, it starts, who's he talking to? He's clearly talking to the king, right? I address my verses to the king. That's verse 1. All right. And your majesty, verse 4, ride out victoriously for the cause of truth and meekness and righteousness. All right. Your arrows are sharp in the heart of the king's enemies. The people fall around you. Your throne, O God, is forever and ever. Okay? I mean, we were talking about the king. What's going on there?
NIV calls Psalm 45 a wedding song.
Why? Where's the female part of this? It's at the end, right? I know that the author of Hebrews is not primarily using it for a wedding context in this particular case. All right. What I find particularly interesting is verse 6 and 7. All right. Knowing the context, he's talking about the king. All right. Verses 6 and 7 together. All right, can be read in a, using Edwardian language, early proto-Trinitarian theology, right? All right, so do you see the logic of where this would go? So at verse 6, it addresses, all right, now who holds the scepter in this case in the first few verses? Who's the kingly person? Earthly king, right? Clearly, earthly king. You get here, and now is the king at this point called God? Right, your throne, O God, and the answer is yes. Right, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. And ever, the scepter of your kingdom is a scepter of uprightness. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. All right, great thing to say about a king. And then it says, therefore, God, your God, and this is where Trinitarian theology comes in, because it's talking to someone who's called God, and then it says, therefore, God, your God. All right. Has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions. And this is not the only time in the Old Testament that this shows up. We will actually see it later on in a selection from this very same Hebrews chapter. All right. Now, if you go down to verse 10, you do see the daughter part, which would be why it might be called a wedding song. Because it does, in fact, talk about a wedding and then sons and things like that. But what's going on, all right, if we recall from the events of the New Testament, various things about Christ were hidden in the Old Testament. And they were hidden on purpose, right? They were hidden on purpose. And they were revealed by Christ himself. And we'll see that here again in a minute, all right? Where he will point to a psalm. Jesus in one of the Gospels points to a psalm and says, read that. How do you explain that in your theology? And those who are listening can't. Jesus is pointing to something interesting. And so what's going on here is the author of Hebrews reads this and goes, this is one of those places where we have two gods, clearly. All right? There's a God whose throne is established forever, and then God has anointed, his own God has anointed him. And of course, Christianity is no more polytheistic than the Old Testament is, than Judaism was. It's a monotheistic religion. All right? There is truly one God. But, as the classic Christian formulation would be, there are three persons. All right? In this case, it would be Christ being anointed by God the Father. Okay? Yes?
Jews have had more of a acceptance of their king being a deity, specifically Yahweh, than later, just, you know, first they had God and then they rejected him and then became a king.
Yeah, only the bad ones.
Yeah.
Right? The Orthodox Jews would know there is truly only one God, for sure.
And that he's the king, that, like, God would overlap, and like, yeah, God is our king, not just a human, and also we have God.
So within, if we think about just Orthodox Old Testament theology, all right, what's the relationship between God and the king? All right, God is creator of all things, eternal. So in a different class than David or Saul. All right, so that much is very clear. What you also have in the Old Testament is you have, and this will come up here in Hebrews, you have the explicit adoption of the king as God's son. All right? God, when God talks to David, he says, you're my son. All right? Does suddenly David turn into a pre-existent eternal being? No. Not. And so that much is there. So there is a very close relationship between God and that particular man in a way that there is not a relationship between God and other men. So for sure. That is good Old Testament theology. Would, as Jews strayed from the right, as they often did, as you know, if you're an Old Testament reader, would they have gone further and gone and said, you know what, maybe the kings are gods too? They certainly would have done that. And the reason why is it was very common in the ancient world to say that kings are gods. And so that would have been a fairly normal, wrong theological move for unfaithful Jews to make. So does that answer where you're going? Because in the Old Testament, no, the king was not God per se. He was adopted by God.
Jews asking, when did they start associating God?
David. Yeah.
Well, human, like that he was the king before they rejected him and wanted Saul, or you know, Saul was chosen. Like at first, God was the king, and then they're like, "Well, no, we want a human king that we can see."
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering if he's trying to bring it back. Like, no, God is always your king, and this guy that you can see is actually the king that is God from before.
I think you're right on that. Yes, I think there's an explicit association, right? In terms of the theologically speaking, the difference between the hidden and the clear will of God, permissive will of God versus his decorative will, right? Did God want the Israelites to have a king? The answer is no. He did not want them to have a king, right? As you said, when Samuel complained about the fact that they wanted a king, God said, "Not your problem. My problem. They're not complaining against you. They're complaining against me." Saul, if I recall correctly, was never called the Son of God. I could be wrong on that. I believe that started specifically with David. All right. And it's very clear there. Right. That's in within the Davidic covenant for sure. And so I do think, yes, because God replaced tribal cooperation with king, he did make a explicit special relationship with the king to establish king's mine, and therefore I'm king because I establish him. So yeah, I think that's right. Totally. Any other thoughts?
No way that we can know what they how they go with verse 7. If God is one, he of Israel, God is one, why are there two gods?
It's a fantastic question.
But there's no way to know how. Is there a way to know how they choose?
If you would have had writings from that period of time, then we could know.
Sure.
Right? And that's what... And that's getting ahead of ourselves. There's another one of these ambiguous places in the Psalms where Jesus says, quotes a psalm and says, what do you do with that? Knowing that they have no answer. All right? Christianity has an answer. The Christ is God, all right? Trinitarian theology, proto-incipient, early Trinitarian theology. Okay, now, if you would turn back to the book of Hebrews. So in terms of his argument, all right, the point of first chapter is to argue the supremacy of the Son over the angels, right? He will argue the supremacy of the Son over other things as well later in the book. But here it's primarily over the angels. The angels are ministers. What's the Son? Well, he's sitting on a throne. That doesn't sound like a minister. And the scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. All right? So that's his basic argument there. Verse 10, what does that quote from? Verses 10 through 12, according to your Bibles. Psalm 102. All right. Take some time. Go read Psalm 102 and figure out what that means. Psalm 102, verses 25 through 28, specifically.
Yeah.
It's
attributing all creation to God. And what's the difference between God and creation here? What's that?
He will do with it as he will.
He will do with it as he will. No, that's true. God is eternal, right? That's one of the main things. Eternal, right? They will perish, but you will remain. They will wear out like a garment, and you will change them like a robe, right? Just like you can change a shirt, God can change creation. He's that powerful, and he's that eternal, while creation itself is extremely transitory, right? Now, how do you tie this to Jesus?
Using the prior verses.
All right.
Putting Jesus in there as over the ministers of the ministers of the wind, ministers of flame.
Mm-hmm.
And then next he puts him as the king forever.
Mm-hmm.
But it still doesn't mean he's been there forever, because his God put him there. And now he just said, okay, he also is the one who did creation.
Well, yes.
That he didn't just start as being born as the king or raising to king. He was already there.
Yes.
He just made him bigger all the way each time.
You've got a theological progression in the book of Hebrews. All right. Jesus is God's son. Okay. Well, Jesus is king, and all the angels are supposed to worship him. I mean, that's heretical from a Old Testament standpoint, right? From a New Testament standpoint, not so much. And then finally, not only he wasn't created, he's eternal. Like God the Father is eternal. That puts him in an entirely different class than any other created being. You're absolutely right. Yes.
I just want to go off on what he said. It's not like Jesus was adopted. It's not so. He's not promoting adoptionism here.
That's right.
What he's doing is establishing a clear creator-creature distinction.
Yes.
Saying Jesus goes in this category as creator rather than creature.
Absolutely. Now, that's how you can see the flow in Hebrews. How in the psalm can you connect it? All right. Verse 12. Where'd you get that? Well, if you look at verse 12, and I threw it over to them because this is a kind of a long one to go through all the context. But you, O Lord, are enthroned forever. You are remembered throughout all generations. You will rise in a pity on Zion. Well, that sounds just like what we were talking about in this other psalm. And so the author of Hebrews is reading psalms and psalms and psalms. Clearly, lots of psalms. Because the next selection, which we won't have time to go into detail, is yet another psalm. he's reading them and going, this one clearly talks about Christ the Son as God enthroned. This one is too. Aha, Psalm 102 is also, as it turns out, about Jesus. I think that's ultimately the connection. And I think there's some other connections as well. But to me, that's the most explicit one. Now, if you would turn back to the author of Hebrews, once again, whoever that was, the book of Hebrews, the very last verse that is quoted, and we won't take the time since we are running out of time. Verse 13, and to which of the angels has he ever said, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? Now, this is from Psalm 110. All right. If you turn to Psalm 110 real quick. This psalm is obviously extremely important for this particular book, the book to the Hebrews. All right. And the reason why is it's not only this verse that's quoted. You see in 110:1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. So once again, we have Lord talking to Lord. All right. Lord sends forth from Zion your mighty scepter. Rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people will offer themselves freely on the day of your power in holy garments from the womb of the morning. The dew of your youth will be yours. The Lord has sworn and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. That theological point is a major argument in the book of Hebrews a few chapters after this. And so this one's interesting because he will use it at least for two separate arguments, the same very short psalm. And the only other thing I'd point out about this in terms of how you connect it to the Son, all right, you've got Jesus implicitly doing this, though he doesn't fully give the answer. I think it's just because he wants to leave the people listening to him stumped. He wants to leave them in confusion. If you will see this in Matthew 22, Mark 12, and Luke 20. So this is in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. Matthew 22, verse 44. This is right after the, what is the greatest commandment question? All right. Now, while the Pharisees were gathered together, Jesus asked them a question. All right. So now he's turning the table. You keep asking me hard questions. I keep giving you answers. Now I'm going to ask you a hard question and see what you can tell me. What do you think about the Christ? Whose son is he? They said to him, well, he's the son of David. Okay, so the Messiah will be in the son of David. Okay, and he said to them, how is it then that David in the Spirit calls him Lord? The Lord said to my Lord. All right, so in other words, what he's saying here is David is speaking about somebody that's not himself. All right, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I put your enemies under your feet. If then David calls him Lord, how is he his son? And no one was able to answer him a word. All right. The author of Hebrews is not like Jesus in this case. Jesus wanted to leave them in confusion, right? Because they were being punks, all right? The author of Hebrews is like, nope, let's make this very clear. Jesus is God. Psalm teaches that. And that's what Jesus is saying here. And they can't answer it because they, well, the Jews were not into early incipient proto-Trinitarian theology, right? Okay, so that is it for today. I wanted to make sure we got through this particular chapter. Next Lord's Day, Lord willing, we will continue in Hebrews chapter 2. Does anybody have any final questions or thoughts before we dismiss for the day?
One clue to that first verse, Psalm 110, is one word, Lord, is spelled in all caps and the other one is not.
Mm-hmm. And what's the significance of that? What's all caps mean?
All caps is the covenant name of Yahweh.
That's right.
And the other Lord is reference to the Son.
That's right.
I've got a question. Anybody else? I've got an NIV here. In Matthew 22:44, both words Lord are spelled with no all caps.
Mm-hmm.
They're both spelled in small case.
Yes.
Is that an error on the part of the NIV?
It is not.
Okay.
The reason why this would happen is the Hebrew word for the covenant name of God is that. If you bring it into English, you'll see that it's all consonants. All right. Generally speaking, in your Hebrew manuscripts, you won't find consonants around that word. Partially so that people would not be able to say you. Right. You lose the consonants, you lose the ability to say it. And this was meant to highlight the fact that this is the covenant name of God. Of course, they wouldn't have that. They would have this. All right. You're never going to see this in the New Testament. The reason why is that's Hebrew, and the New Testament was written in Greek. And so often in your Old Testament translated into Greek, you're going to see the same word for both, which is the word for Lord. And so if you look in your New Testament manuscripts, you don't see the covenant name of the Old Testament covenant name of God because it's not written in Hebrew. It is written in Greek. So therefore, you don't see it. So not a mistake, as it turns out. Good question, though. Anybody else?
So, okay. This morning when we read the Proverbs, and multiple times it was Lord in all caps, he said Jehovah.
That's right.
Which is an attempt to bring this Yahweh over into, where isn't it the vowels from Adonai they added to that to make Jehovah?
Yes.
Which Yehovah, I guess, is more right. But that only happens in the Old Testament.
Yes.
That comes up in our worship, because when we see Lord in all caps, we say Jehovah to remind us that's not just the normal Lord, that's like the covenant name.
That's right.
We never have that issue in the New Testament. It's not used.
That's right. Because it's a different language. It's just always one single word. All right. If you've heard in songs, all right, you'll hear this word, Kyrie eleison. Kyrie, what's English? All right. Kyrie eleison is Lord have mercy. All right. If you've ever heard that in a song, this is the Greek word for Lord. And so that's the word that you'll see in the New Testament, because the New Testament's not written in Hebrew. It's written in Greek. Yeah. And so you can maintain that in the Old Testament. And so when we read from the Proverbs, just like Bill said, it's there and it's maintained. And you'll see that in your English Old Testaments a lot too. And that's what they mean. Yeah. Okay, let's go ahead and be dismissed. If anybody wants to talk about any of this more, talk to me during lunch.